Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 70 for May 23rd, 2009, Bug Labs. Floss Weekly is brought to you by the 2009 Google Summer of Code Project. The Google open source program has announced the student projects accepted for 2009. Students are now busy coordinating with their mentor organizations and getting their code work underway. You can get involved in the open source community next year at code.google.com/SOC. Make sure you tell them you heard about it on Floss Weekly. It's time for Floss Weekly. Floss. Once again, thank Jeff Robbins of Lullabot and the formerly of the group Orbit for that great Floss Weekly. I think that's him.
Indeed,
it's appropriate this week. Hello, Randall Schwartz.
Hey, Leo. Good to talk to you again.
Floss at twit.tv. How are you liking that new email?
It's working out really well because, you know, it's so much simpler than my real address, which is Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, at stonehenge.com, which is way too hard for anybody to spell. Yeah. So it's really nice that we've got that set up. And, you know, now that we've been bringing in the bacon a couple of times, if he wants to actually help me out with the show, I can actually forward the mail to him as well. So it'll work out really nice.
You mean John O'Bacon?
John O'Bacon, yes, the Flossing with Bacon. He's actually, he loved last week's show, really enjoyed being on it, and wrote me immediately after that show and said, can I do some more? Can I do some more?
Oh, please, absolutely.
And so we have him on a couple of upcoming shows. We'll talk about that at the end of the show here.
You know, you and I are going to be in China. I wonder maybe if he wants to take over a little bit while we're gone. Or we could pre-tape, of course. But
well, we have to pre-tape, I think. Actually, you know.
He could host. We could have somebody here run the board for him.
My God, I'm so happy he was on last week's show because he knew a lot more about OpenMocha than I did.
Yeah, or me.
And so it was nice to have his feedback and opinions. I really thank you, John. If you're listening out there, I'm really appreciating what you're doing for the show so far. It's been a real pleasure so far. I'm happy. I'm excited because between last week's show and this week's show, speaking of the previous show, I got to go to San Jose. Do you know the way to San Jose? I got to fly to San Jose. And the reason I was there is that now that I'm on the board of Linux Fund at linuxfund.org, where we're giving away money to open source projects, we decided that it's our 10th anniversary, coinciding roughly with OSCON, and OSCON's in San Jose, so we would throw a huge 10th anniversary party. Now, this is actually being presented by my company, Stonehenge, which has a legendary reputation for the biggest parties ever at OSCON. And
in fact,
we haven't done them in a couple of years, so it's really great to be back in the swing of things, making huge party plans. And so I took my friend Bill Harp down there, and we scouted out, and we found a couple of really good locations. I can't announce it yet because we're still negotiating between three different places to see who's going to give us the best deal. So I can't announce the place yet, but let me tell you, it is going to be an incredible party. We're talking, you know, free alcohol, free music, DJs coming in, a couple of special surprises, may even do some live video streaming. You and I talked about that in an email a couple of days ago.
Yep.
So maybe we get some live plays. One of the places that we're looking at has a really great location that would sort of quieter, but still within the traffic flow. So it'll be great for doing like live streaming. We'll be able to hear and talk with some of the people we're trying to bring in. I'm looking forward to it, and so it's fun to be back in the party mode again. So that'll be on July 22nd. If you're anywhere near downtown San Jose on July 22nd and you walk up to hear this really loud party and all these people wearing these really cool T-shirts that say 10th anniversary party, just come up to the front door and say, I know Randall. Let me in. So I'll get you in.
I'm a friend of Randall.
That's right. Why four, not three? Oh, F-O-R. Okay, sorry. I can't.
Well, it could be a force, a friend of Randall Schwartz. I'm a force.
Okay, right. That's very crazy.
Who do we have? Who's the show about today, this week?
So. The show this week, very cool. Before we get to the guest, I want to show you what I'm wearing, all the people at home. I'm wearing one of these wonderful T-shirts from your friend Lori
Walsh.
Lori LeBeau
Walsh. What does that say now? It says the internet is not your friend.
That's right. It's Security Now. It's a Security Now t-shirt.
Oh.
So she gave me t-shirts to talk about them. They are very good, high-quality t-shirts, yeah. And I love them. And thank you, Lori, for giving me the shirts. And they basically are now outfitting me for the entire week. And where do they go to find out about those, Leo?
Well, my friend, they go to Art and Tech Tees. That's where. That's Lori's mm-hmm. great site, ArtandTechTees.
Yep.
And they have a great number of limited edition t-shirts made in California. Mm-hmm. You get your Twit Army shirts. Don't bother me. I'm waxing my yacht.
Mm-hmm.
The internet is not your friend. Interweb tubes. That's mm-hmm. the Net at Night shirt this week in tech, of course, with the full Twit staff. So this is a great site to go to if you want to get these great Twit shirts. Lori is the woman who does our album arts. Nitrozak and Snaggy do the illustrations, and Lori puts it into an album art. And she does such a great job. She did the Floss Weekly album art. And these t-shirts are so nice.
It's way cool. And if you go to the website, you don't get the girl with the shirt.
I knew you were going to say that. I almost said it. Then I had the good sense not to.
Go there. You know I'm going to go there, Leo. That's the way it works like that. So before I really interrupted, you asked me who's going to be on this week. This week, a real cool opportunity here. We're talking to the people from Bug Labs, not the people, the person. Actually, I think it's employee number 2, Ken Gilmer of Bug Labs, and he's going to talk to us about these hardware devices that are like infinitely reprogrammable. I think there's an embedded Linux in there, and
wow.
There's different modules you plug on it, like some like do GPS and stuff. And so I didn't research too much before this show, but apparently it's pretty cool. It's a little different from Arduino like we had on a few weeks ago, but I think it's similar. We'll have to ask him what the differences are.
Well, good. We're going to do that in just a second. But first I want to mention the Google Summer of Code GSOC. This is the thing that Google does every year, bringing together computer science students with open source organizations. The students get to code. They get to learn about open source. They get to participate in, you know, open source projects they've been reading and hearing about. They get a real sense of what they're up to. They can put it on their resume. It's a great resume builder. You get some real world software development experience. It's a wonderful thing that Google does. I'm really thrilled that they do this every year. Summer of Code is coming up any minute now. Too late to participate this year. They've already picked both their mentoring organizations and their students. But it's not too late to start thinking about next year. So the way it will work, you have till, I would say by February, you should be had visited the site and prepared your presentation as a mentoring group. You want to submit those open source project ideas to Google. Google will post them in March of 2010, accepting 150 of them. And then students apply. And Google will choose about 150 students to participate in the Google Summer of Code. Now, here's what it takes to qualify as a mentoring organization. You have to be a group running an active, free, or open source software project. You do not have to be a legally incorporated entity. You have to produce and release software under an OSI-approved license. If you want to see previous year's mentor organizations, get an idea of what kind of organizations participate, go to code.google.com/SOC. You can see this year's and previous year's mentoring organizations to see if you feel like you fit in. I'm sure you do if you've qualified. I'm sure Pearl's been involved. Drupal,
yeah,
I know,
Pearl's
been
involved. Pearl's been involved almost every year, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a Python. It's a great idea. I really applaud Google for doing it. Mm-hmm. If you do apply next year, make sure you tell them you heard about it on Floss Weekly, so we get a little credit with them. I just encourage you to check it out. Google Summer of Code. Go to code.google.com/SOC, or, as Randall is wont to point out, Google it.
Just Google it.
Google Summer of Code, and you'll find out more about it.
Yes.
We thank them so much for their support of Floss Weekly. Mm-hmm. I'm ready to go talk to Ken.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe he is on the line from Southern Japan, where it is early in the morning. Ken Gilmer of Bug Labs, welcome to Floss Weekly. Good to talk to you. Thank you for getting up so early.
Thanks, Leo. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's pretty early here. It looks like it's going to be not too bad of a day. It was supposed to rain a lot, but looks like it's not raining yet. Looking forward to maybe getting on a bicycle this morning after the interview.
What city are you in?
It's a small town called Shimabara. It's famous for during an earlier phase, 200 or 300 years ago, they would dip Christians in boiling water to have them renounce their faith to
Fantastic.
Make sure that Christianity didn't take over in Japan.
Excellent.
And
did it?
Seems to have worked.
No. Well done. My goodness. Well, that's, you know, you're not far from Nagasaki. In fact, you're in Nagasaki. Is it prefecture?
State.
State.
Yes, prefecture, exactly.
So we.
It's about an hour by car. And because Japan is very mountainous, it takes about 2.5 hours to get there because the roads are very windy and they don't really have these, like, you know, wide open spaces and you can't really go very fast. So it takes a while to get anywhere. But it's really nice to.
Now, this isn't home for you. What brings you to Japan today?
I'm actually live in Brooklyn, New York with my wife, and we just had a baby about a month ago, and we decided to she's Japanese, and we decided to come here and do all that stuff with her family. It's our first baby, and we don't really know what to do. So,
congratulations.
Nice. Thanks. Yeah, everybody's been very supportive, and Japan is definitely a very nice country to have a baby in,
I highly
recommend it if you're ever considering.
It's a quick learning curve, though. You don't have to worry, Ken. It'll all, within a month, you'll be an old hand.
Yeah. It's great.
If you can build, well, now let's talk about Bug Labs briefly, because I completely didn't understand what Bug Labs was. At first, I thought, oh, it's a debugger. Not so.
Right. That would be easier, because it would be a simpler product to build. But no, the Bug is a Linux computer. It is handheld. I'm kind of holding it with the camera here.
It is handheld. I see. You're holding it by hand.
And The idea is you attach physical modules to this base, and it allows you to create custom gadgets. And we provide everything from the hardware, the electronics, to the plastics, to different modules you attach, as well as all the software that runs internally, the operating system, which is custom Linux, and application layer, which lets it make it easy for developers to write hardware-based applications without a lot of the pain and complexities of traditional embedded development.
This is really cool. Now, we talked with OpenMoko last week about open hardware. Is this open hardware, open software, both?
It's both similar in ways to OpenMoko. The hardware designs are GPL, so anyone can build their own modules as well as if they chose to build their own base units as well. So, yep.
Wow.
Same as OpenMoko in that regard.
Yeah.
And clearly the software is all open software, right? So.
That's correct. Our entire system is buildable. We use the same project, actually. The same root project to build the operating system is called Open Embedded. And the OpenMoko stack uses that as well. So, turns out a lot of the software that OpenMoko uses, we also use, and there's a lot of kind of cross-pollination in terms of different apps that get developed for OpenMoko. We can consume that and so forth. I think we'll get into a little later, but one of the core things that the Bug uses is open source Java, and so that's one of the areas where Bug has kind of contributed some back to various communities in terms of embedded devices and Java.
So let's start with the base. That was, I know not everybody can see this because some people are listening to the netcast.
Sure.
So can you describe the size of the thing you just held up?
Yeah, it's about like, it's bigger than a deck of cards. It's not something you're going to put in your, you know, unlike the Sony Vaio, it's not something you're going to put in your back pocket, but it's fairly small. It's something you could put in a backpack or, you know.
You could almost put it in your back pocket. I mean, it's not that big.
Right. I mean, I guess you probably could do it. It just probably wouldn't last very long if you did.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind. That's good to know.
Yeah.
And so this is basically a portable Linux box. We're running Linux on, is it an ARM processor inside there?
Exactly. It's a MX31 from Freescale. It's a system on a chip. It has 128 megs of RAM. We boot the operating system off of a MMC or SD card. It has a built-in battery and USB, some different connectivity options, and then
can I pull the
like
SD card? Is the SD card built into it, or can I pull it out and put something else on it?
You can pull it out and put something else on it. One of the whole ideas was that we wanted to make it kind of less threatening and easier for people to play around with embedded devices. And usually you have this problem where you have to flash a device to get some new version of software on it, but maybe the flash doesn't work right and you've bricked it, or it's hard to get back. So one of the strategies we have is to put everything on the SD card. So when you turn it on, it just boots that. If you don't like it, you can pop the card out and put something else in. And in that way, it's similar to a desktop machine where you can switch out hard drives very easily and experiment with new operating systems.
Once it's booted, though, it's released the SD, so I can go ahead and pull it out, right?
No, that would be like disconnecting the hard drive from a running PC.
Okay, so it doesn't boot off and then boot into a RAM disk or something. It actually continues to read the SD card as its home drive then.
You got it. Okay. You could configure it that way. You could configure it to run off a RAM disk, and then you could use the SD card as a storage device. But as it ships from the factory, it requires the SD card to boot and to run from.
So we've got a USB, we've got the SD card. There's also, if I remember, this is bug base we're describing, right? The sort of main core unit. And there's like a lot of hardware on the front, like little switches, toggle switches, a little display or something. What's on there? What else is on there?
Yeah, so there's a front panel which has a small monochrome LCD screen, and we have a basic menu interface to let you configure things. So one of the challenges for this device is that we wanted to make it versatile and usable for a large variety of different kinds of hardware. So most devices, like, for example, an OpenMoco or a laptop, the hardware is built into the device. So the software people can just assume that it has a display, or the display is a certain resolution. They can assume that it has a keyboard. But with the bug, because essentially almost everything is modular, we had to kind of throw that out and build a system that could work reasonably well at a low level without things like a display. So on the front, there's a small LCD screen for very minimal, configuration things. There's a menu system and like a little clock and whatnot. And there's some hotkeys for application programmers to use to trigger events. On the side, there's a tripod mount, so you can attach it to a tripod and do, I don't know, all sorts of crazy things with that. On the back, there's a mini USB adapter, SD card slot. There's a power jack and a power switch, and that's about it.
I love how modular this is. This is really an interesting way to just do this.
Is this internal batteries then, and are they rechargeable? Do they charge off the power plug or what?
That's correct. So the battery is internal and it runs the full length of the device. Mm-hmm. And then there's also support. We don't have the modules currently, but there's also support for power devices as modules. So the idea might be that you could use a solar cell or a lithium iron battery module to add more power to the device.
And,
they also support
now?
Charging across from module to module. So you could have two batteries plugged in, and the bug would just kind of figure out which battery had the most juice and then use that.
Oh, that's neat.
What kind of timing do you get from just running the bug base by itself?
That's a good question. I haven't really timed that out.
I mean, we're talking 10 minutes or an hour or a week?
We're talking probably like a couple hours.
Okay.
It depends on what you're running. At idle, I've seen them go for 4 or 5 hours at idle.
Okay.
As soon as you start adding things like GPS modules and LCD screens, that starts to get cut down quite a bit.
So we keep talking about these modules. So what are some of the modules that you're already providing that plug in with this base unit?
The modules we have currently are this. Oh, my screen just went to sleep. An LCD screen. It's the same part as the iPod video. So it's a QVGA screen, and it has a touch screen. And we have X windows running on the base unit, and we have two. It's a dual-headed system, which is kind of a weird, unusual setup. You don't really get a lot of that in the embedded world as a dual-headed, portable Linux computer. So if you plug in an LCD module on both sides of the device, you'll get two different X sessions that you could load apps on.
Wow.
As well as the LCD screen, we have what we call the Von Hippel module, which is kind of a breakout module for hardware hacking. So the what I haven't really talked about here is these...
Why do you call it a Von Hippel?
Eric Von Hippel, Dr. Eric Von Hippel is a professor at MIT, and he's kind of one of the main guys around the ideas of peer innovation and regular people kind of taking over more control over the devices and the artifacts in their world.
Yes.
And
I love
a lot
that
of his
idea.
Work has inspired Bug, and so we wanted to
honor him.
Name a module after him.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Very cool.
There he is. There's Eric Von Hippel for those watching the video. Yep. And he's got all sorts of weird stuff on his wall mounted to plywood. I think that's what's inspiring this whole idea is something that's completely programmable, modular, and kind of soft.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's people out there that can get into embedded C development and know the quirks of building computers from the silicon up. But there's a lot of people that would like to build stuff but can't because they don't have access to that, just don't have that expertise. So the bug is meant for those kinds of people that want to build things but just don't have the time or the expertise to get it done in a traditional way.
So what's in the Von Hippel module?
The Von Hippel module is the breakout. So we have all these ports that are exposed through what we call the BMI interface. Those are just kind of standard embedded interfaces like I2C, serial, USB. The Von Hippel module exposes all those interfaces through a breakout. So if I had an I2C device that I wanted to integrate with the bug, I would simply plug the module into the bug, write a bug application in Java maybe, and then go.
So I was watching the video of Von Hippel, and so you could plug little. It's almost like a breadboarding thing, like you might like in the old Heathkit days, where you could plug stuff in.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Neat.
And it also has lots of flashing lights. It has a blue LED, which is my favorite, but also has green and red. One of my favorite applications that we have is called Christmas Tree. I wrote it. I guess I'm a little biased, but it flashes a lot of LEDs. We have probably like at least 10 LEDs we're flashing, and that really gets the crowds going.
You know who we got to get one of these for, Leo?
Me. I'm buying one right now. I'm online. Oh, Dick would like this just because of the LEDs, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We have a few more modules. This one is pretty cool. The shape, it's a motion detector and a 3-axis accelerometer. So you can, very easily in programming, get access to G-forces that are being applied in real time to a device. And it has this kind of cool dome on the front of it for the motion detection. And I don't know if you guys saw Logan's Run in the 70s, but the dome of this module looks a lot like the building in Logan's Run, where the people fall into the giant energy crystal and get absorbed.
I thought it was going to glow blue so that I would know it was time for me to die.
Yeah.
That's good. I need that. Yeah. That's cool. That's really cool. By the way, there's lots of videos on the buglabs.net site, so you could see how these things work, interact, ideas for stuff to do, and so forth.
So what is that motion detector actually doing? Is it sensing changes in infrared in front of it, or changes in visible light, or is it is it using sound? How's it detecting things?
It's a passive infrared sensor, so I would imagine it's detecting changes in levels in the infrared spectrum. But I'm just a mild-mannered software guy. I'm just kind of going off. Yeah.
So your team has hardware and software people working on this, obviously.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We have a team of various people. Some of them are pure software. Some of them are hardware software.
How big is the team? Yeah, do they all work for Bug Labs, or is there a big community around this?
I would say we have probably about 10 dedicated engineer types that are, you know, working on Bug Labs stuff all the time. And we also have community people who contribute stuff on their own time. So I think, you know, the bug is still kind of getting out there. We have some community involvement. We're always looking for more. But with a device like this, you really need to have people having the hardware to make meaningful contributions that work specifically with the device.
Right.
So what other modules do you have? You've got the GPS, you've got the infrared.
Yeah, so this is the GPS. It's not very exciting to look at, but it's a lot of fun if you get it to work. In New York, we have a hard time in the office. We're at Broadway and Lafayette, which is a very busy area of the city.
Right.
And you just can't get a signal very reliably there. But here in rural Japan, it's very easy. I have a window right here. I just plug it in and I get my long lat coordinates, no problem.
You call that bug locate. So it doesn't have maps. It just gives you longitude and latitude.
Right. As a developer, you plug it in and then it's up to you to write your app to use the location. Or you can go to our website, buglabs.net/applications. And there's already a bunch of location style applications that you could consume if you you want to. So if you wanted to get a map or find out where the nearest, you know, pizza place is to your current location, we have apps like that.
Do you have, does it use the WAAS signal in the North America so I can get better, more accurate location information?
It probably should, because that sounds like a good feature, but I don't think it does. No.
Doesn't that? Okay, yeah, because I know that's like an extra signal, and it's only available apparently in North America, which is really crazy. So it makes it, GPS makes slightly better in North America, huh. Like that.
That's good to know. I didn't know that. I don't. Yes, I would assume it doesn't.
WAAS, it's wide area amplification signal or augmentation signal or something, but it's added on top of the GPS signal. But it's a stationary satellite that sprays North America with slightly updated ephemeral data so that it can tell really where all the satellites are right now.
Huh. Yep. Interesting.
Yep.
So. Another thing we got is this camera, which you can't get. This is unavailable because of...
I want it.
You can't get it. You can't.
We got some noise issues that we have to work out. But it's a 2-megapixel camera, and it makes a lot of apps a lot of fun. When I do demos, I try not to use the camera because people can't get it, but there's just so many fun things you can do with a camera. Just I end up using it anyway. So it's kind of torturous to some people, I think, but I have one and you can't have one. I guess working for a company like Bug Labs, you have to, you know, take advantage of that opportunity when you get it. Are they coming back?
Are the cameras coming back? Is it just that something's wrong with it right now?
It works. It's just that it's a little noisy, so it's not passing some of our tests. So we just have to work on the noise issues, and then hopefully we'll get it out very soon.
Cool.
Being in software, these kinds of problems I don't really have to deal with. I just kind of shrug and, you know, move on. It's great. In the software world, we have, you know, ones and zeros, and the zero is always zero, and a one isn't always a one. So it's this nice layer of abstraction you can just rest on and not worry about the physical universe too much. But the hardware people don't have that luxury. It's pretty amazing, actually.
You do have an SDK for this, too. Dragonfly?
That's correct. It's based on Eclipse, the Java SDK.
Oh, neat.
And We talked about different kind of software technologies to use as the application development platform for the bug in the early days, and Java seemed to be a good match because it's kind of a language that pretty much everybody knows. If you're going to know some languages taught in schools, and there's not too much magic there, and it has a lot of good support for things like networking and threading and concurrency, and it also is a static language, so it lets you control behavior in a way that makes it more predictable to build devices. So Eclipse is a Java, is probably the most popular Java SDK. And there's a lot of built-in support for what we use called OSGI, which is a component framework for Java. So we just kind of took Eclipse and a lot of the OSGI stuff that it already provides and just bolted our stuff on top of that. So the good news is there was a lot of work we didn't have to do,
right?
Because it was already done in Eclipse.
So cool. Who's buying this, and what kinds of things are they doing with it? Is it hobbyists? Is it kids? Is it schools? Is it grown-ups?
There's probably a lot of different groups of people that are buying it.
Does it overlap with Arduino crowd and people like that? Or?
There's definitely a lot of businesses buying it for
interesting.
Like a rapid application development platform for different hardware-based apps. There are, you know, enthusiasts and gadget people that are buying it. There's I think as well, we have an EDU program. We have some school activity going on. There isn't one specific group that is buying it over any other, but it's a little different from Arduino in the sense that it's a full operating system running on a device. So it's a 32-bit computer. It has, you know, all the things that a normal, like modern general purpose computer would have, like storage and network access and that sort of thing. So from my understanding, I don't really do a whole lot of low-level hardware hacking, but Arduino is more kind of it's a smaller device, it has less features, and it has other things like the battery power is much, it can go for longer, and it does like things in a more low level way. So if you just want to like turn some lights on and react to a thermistor, that's really like a good application for Arduino. If you're looking for network integration and some of the more heavy application development stuff, then the bug, I think, is a pretty good way to go.
Can you run Emacs on it?
Yes.
You can.
Of course.
So because we use this build system called Open Embedded, which is essentially a way of building Linux, all of the work of of VI or Emacs or any of the kind of classic Linux tools. That stuff's already provided. We just we get it out of the box, and so do our customers.
So do people do actual, like, use the device itself to edit code, or they always edit code somewhere else then download it to the machine?
You can do that. You can attach a USB keyboard, and you could. I think we've even had like a video. They have these USB video monitor things. So it goes from USB to video. So we've definitely had one developer who's used it in that way. But I would probably still develop on my laptop.
Yeah, that makes more sense anyway. Unless you're like, you know, if you're out on a desert island and this is the only device you have, but you happen to have a USB keyboard and USB video display, I guess.
Yep. And some kind of power source on that island.
Yes. Was there a 3G, a GSM module for this?
We're working on one, but we don't have anything shipping right now. We have one for data for the GSM, so it wouldn't be like a phone.
But it would give you wireless connectivity, ubiquitous wireless connectivity. Yeah.
Exactly. We're also working on a Wi-Fi module that also isn't released, but I have one right here. It has Bluetooth.
You can't have it, Randall. Calm down.
Another thing that he's got that I can't have.
Can't have it. So do you have one of these, Randall, the Bug Labs?
No, I don't. Not yet.
I'm going to. It's a little pricey. It would add up. I mean, it's $250 for the base, and then the additional units are anywhere from $60 to $120. So it could add up. If you put something together, you're going to end up spending more than you might on a netbook, maybe.
That's true. But you get the ability to write custom hardware apps very easily, which is kind of cool.
Right.
So the bus that connects the modules with the base unit, that's open specification, obviously. Have third parties come along and provided hardware modules for people to use?
Yeah, we've had. We don't have any like shipping modules that others have provided, but we have definitely had different people, from just normal community members to large corporations, talk about using our bus to build their own modules. The thing is, the hardware interface itself is, I guess, a Bug Labs thing, but it's not. There's nothing really proprietary about it. We're taking essentially a standard connector, which is called a Samtec connector, and we're exposing it through this physical interface, and we're just essentially taking all the interfaces that are provided off the system on a chip, ARM CPU, plus a few others. We're just exposing those interfaces through this connector. And then we have some wrapping code around that to treat the entire thing as a hot plug interface. But really what's going on is just standard traditional vanilla embedded interfaces. So it's not a custom protocol.
And what are some of the typical applications that you've seen with this, other than sort of the toying around with it? Because you talked about some industrial use and some educational use. What have you seen? Or actually, I guess the question is, what's the most unusual thing you've seen done with this so far?
I've seen a lot of unusual things, but I would say that
in my years on this planet, my eyes have seen.
Yes,
I think where we're getting a lot of the most interest is in merging kind of the traditional embedded stuff with more business needs. So the fact that you can run a database on this and connect to a web server, or use it as a web server and publish your GPS coordinates as an RSS feed, things like that are what's really making people interested, as opposed to, I guess, more low-level embedded devices like Arduino.
Maybe you asked this, Randall, how much space is available for user code after the operating
system? It ships with a 2-gig SD card, and I think that what we ship is works out to be about 120 meg, so, you know.
It's quite a bit of room left.
80 megs.
And then how much RAM is available to the user?
It's got 128 megs of memory, and at any one time, Java is probably taking about 10% of that, and the rest is pretty much free.
So there's a lot of space. I mean, this is as easy to use.
Yeah, we think of it more as a general purpose computer than an embedded system.
Right.
I think what you're seeing a lot of, too, is that traditional embedded processors and what you think of as traditional general purpose computers like x86, they're kind of merging. You see like talk about, you know, Windows 7 running on ARM, and you see this kind of activity right now on netbooks and other small devices using ARM processors over x86 processors. And this is, I think, another example of that, where you kind of have, from a software perspective, it's a general purpose computer. It can do pretty much anything a normal computer can
do.
But it's also kind of rooted in the embedded system, low power consumption.
So I could, for example, make a point of sale terminal with this by adding just a few more pieces of hardware then.
That's correct. You would have to, you'd probably have to do some custom module development for accessing. I don't know what interfaces you'd need for that. Maybe serial or USB.
Things like barcode readers. Well, I guess if you had, but you have, you have USB, so you could have, do you have Bluetooth?
We were almost shipping the Wi-Fi module, which includes Bluetooth.
That's right. Wi-Fi and Bluetooth.
But yeah, there's USB 2.0, both on the go and standard hosts mode, so you can attach USB devices, and if the
so you could have a standard barcode scanner, and then it's
barcode scanners, RFID. We have a big list of crazy modules that we want to build, like Geiger counters and robotic extensions and man machine or attachments, that sort of thing.
Well, you already got a baby monitor and a seismograph.
That's what I'm looking at.
Oh, yes. I bet you are.
Yeah.
Better hurry up.
You suddenly realize your whole set, the problems you have to deal with in your daily life radically change.
Oh, yeah.
The kinds of apps you want very, very much change.
I'm surprised that you don't have things like a contractions monitor, things like that.
All that's over, thankfully. Right
yeah.
Now.
You know, well, so far. Yeah, for a while.
So far.
Yeah.
Has anyone made a Beowulf cluster of these?
No. Some of the initial use cases and ideas were to take sets of them and attach them together and form some kind of super cluster. But that use case was never really.
Yeah, Skynet. I was going to say at the beginning.
Bugnet.
Yeah, we were never really able to truly prove that use case actually existed in the real world. We haven't actually implemented any of that stuff yet. But there's interest there. People always ask that question. Kind of feel like we should just do it.
Of course. I don't think any. Yeah, they just ask it. Nobody really wants it. They just say.
You know what you need as the company motto? It's not a feature; it's a bug.
We have a hard time because internally, when we talk about bugs, we call them defects. Not bugs. So
the initiation
process for a new developer, a bug is don't call it a bug; call it a defect. It's kind of it gets on our nerves when you call it a bug.
In this case, a bug is good, not bad. Yeah,
exactly. It's a good bug, not
it's
a bad
bug.
Bug.
It's not a cockroach. It's not a program error. It's a bug.
I'm surprised you don't have a module that has legs then so you can crawl with this.
Well, yeah, we have some guys that were interested in building tank treads, and we had a guy come into our what we call a test kitchen. It's just kind of a little part of our office where people can break out a soldering iron and stick things together. We had a guy come in and build up little wheels. Like car wheels was attached to a battery.
I could see robotics. That's the next step. You got to have robotics applications.
Yeah, we had one guy who built a platform, had three wheels, and had this giant man-killing claw that would just kind of roam around the office. And the claw was removed, so, yeah.
Oh, yeah, these would go well in something like Robot Wars or whatever, right? You put them as the smarts for that, have a lot of AI in that because it's got enough power for that.
We got Robot Wars coming up in San Francisco, actually, in a couple of weeks. I'm going to be emceeing it. I think it's at the Palace of Leisure. I'll have to find out where it's going to be.
Other unusual applications have you seen for this?
Well, I think the best thing to do is go to our website, go to buglabs.net/applications, and there you'll see pretty much everything that people have written. It's publicly available. We kind of have it's kind of a blend of a source control repository and a blog and a SourceForge kind of site where you can see apps, you can see how they work, you can see what hardware they require, and if you're using the SDK, you click once through the SDK and it'll download all the source code for an application into your workspace and you can immediately start working. So that was one of the kind of key problems we were trying to address with the bug is that if you're someone who's just trying to solve a problem, you want to build an embedded device, you kind of start with some pieces and it's a very steep curve from, getting this box in the mail to having something that just will just turn on and you have a prompt. That is a whole universe of pain if you're not familiar with embedded development. So with the bug device itself, with the SDK and with BugNet, which you just saw on the screen, we're trying to make that much, much easier, make it much simpler to just get started for folks.
Somebody in the chat room asked, "How does Android run on this, and how does it relate to anything
Android,
that you're talking about?"
We don't have anything working on Android for the bug right now. It'd be cool to definitely get that working. We just haven't had the internal people to play around with it. Android is a hot topic. Everybody's talking about Android. There's always, you know, the new Android port, some new device is coming out with Android. It would definitely be fun to have Android on the device. And I don't actually know too much about Android, but as far as I know, it wouldn't be a technical problem.
It is a Linux,
it's an ARM-based device.
Yeah.
I think the OpenMoco, someone ported Android to that, right?
Yeah.
It's a very similar device in terms of the hardware. It shouldn't be a problem. When you guys get that done, let me know. I'd like to blog that. So
cool.
Maybe next week you guys can port.
What is your blog, Ken?
If you go to community.buglabs.net, it's not a planet per se, but it's kind of the place where different people kind of come together and talk about things related to bug.
Cool.
So it's just running a standard version of Linux, right?
It is running, it's running something called Pocky Linux, which is a subset of Open Embedded, and it's a standard kernel with some added extensions for the MX31 CPU, and the user space is all provided standard from Pocky and Open Embedded. So, for example, Emacs, the code that you would run on the device, you can get packages similar to standard desktop Debian or Ubuntu, where you can just run the package manager and install some new app very easily. You can do a similar, not quite as easy, but a similar kind of idea where you install a binary package from a website.
And there's a site already for packages specifically related to Bug Labs?
Not really. We're working on that. We kind of have what we base ship, and then we have kind of the software platform that we use for Java development and for web service development. But to do like the native packages where you would install Emacs or something like a new kernel, we don't really have that exposed in the same way yet, but we're working on that.
How long has Bug Labs been around?
It's just not as easy as it should be yet. Yeah. We've been around as a company for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. I'm the number two employee, and I've been here for 3 years. It seems like it's only been like 6 months, but it's been 3 years. It's kind of strange.
And
but
did it start
great.
Out? Did it start out being? Was there a profit model from day one, or did you just say, "Well, I want to build these things and hope that someday it provides some sort of income for somebody"?
There was a profit model from day one. I don't really know what that is. You know, just again, a mild-mannered software guy. But it definitely involves
profit,
you know,
what's that? Yeah.
Profit, cash. These things, these simple concepts I understand. And you know, we think that there's definitely a need for a device that kind of merges embedded development and easier, more general purpose tools to make it easy to build custom devices. And this goes for education, business, as well as individuals.
Designs are all open. Do you have any fears that somebody will come along and undercut your price?
I think not really. I think if we're successful to the degree that someone would do that to us, then we probably have other fish to fry. So far, that hasn't been an issue. But it's always always a concern, I guess. At least at a high level, when you're an open hardware company, that someone will take you up on your offer to make new versions of that hardware. The thing is also for us is the bug is a pretty, complex product. It's a fairly modern CPU with a lot of, ICs integrated onto the board. So it would be fairly difficult for someone to just kind of come in and take the design and move on with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's some kind of built-in. It's unlike, because unlike software where you can just fork some source repository and begin your own project right away. In hardware, you have a lot of physical universe constraints which prevent you from doing things like just copying the source and starting your own project. So I don't think that's really as much of a concern in the hardware world.
Cool.
Well, I thank you so much, Ken, for being here. It makes me want to run out and buy one of these suckers.
Please do. Please do. Yeah. And we're actually in about a week or 2 weeks, in June 3rd, there's a conference called Java 1.
Right.
It's a big Java conference. We're going to be We're going to be there. We're going to have a booth. We're going to be doing a BOF. I can't recall which day, but it's in the evening. So please, if you're interested, go to buglabs.net, and there will be details regarding where to see us at Java 1.
Good.
There.
Cool. Very cool.
And hopefully we'll have some devices at the show to sell and to play around with, of course.
You got any bugs twittering yet?
We have an application called Bug Tweet and Twitch, which is kind of my, I think it's an accelerometer-based Twitter front end.
I'm not moving again.
The device
I'm not moving.
That tweets. I think it's pretty sweet. I like the name more than anything. But
yeah.
But yeah, so we do have a Twitter app.
How do you get connectivity to the net?
Right now, there's a built-in interface on the baseport. It's RJ45, just standard Ethernet.
Oh.
It's hard to use that because we don't sell any adapter that will let that work. But there's the USB. We can do IP over USB.
Oh, okay.
And as soon as the Wi-Fi module ships, then you'll have that
sure. And
GSM and so forth.
And then they'll be twittering bugs everywhere.
Exactly. It'll be a beautiful, beautiful world.
Beautiful world full of...
little motion sensor keeps twittering.
I'm moving.
I don't see anybody.
Nobody
I don't
here.
See anybody. Else.
Where am I? I don't know.
I still don't see anybody.
I still see anybody.
There's still nobody here.
Okay.
I'm now on my back. I'm now face up again.
I can't get up. Ken, I want to thank you so much. I know it's very early in the morning. Enjoy your beautiful day in Japan.
Absolutely.
And your beautiful new baby as well, Mira. That's wonderful. Congratulations to you and your wife.
And, thank you very much, guys.
Thanks for sharing this with us. It's just really, really interesting.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Ken Gilmer of buglabs.net, all the way from the Far East.
Yes.
As opposed
far to... Far East relative to us, anyway.
From us. For him, we're in the Far East.
That's right. Actually, I guess they're west of us, aren't they? Yeah, a little.
Well,
or Far East,
you can go either
way.
Around.
That's the Far East. Yeah, that's the Far East part. All the way around.
The planet... you may not know this yet, is round.
I've heard that. Well, that was pretty cool.
I love this kind of stuff. It's a little pricey. I mean, you know, by the time you add all the modules you want, you're talking $500 or $600, I think.
Yeah, that's the thing I didn't like about it. I was like, okay, you know.
But that's going to... They have a business model, though, which I like. And this is keeping... Ken and a bunch of other people employed and putting out new stuff. And sometimes it's, you know, I think sometimes in open source, we have a prejudice against profit.
Yeah, there's sort of a starving artist mentality to it. And I'm never quite understanding that because, you know, I've made my living, you know, gladly for the last 20 years off of open source software and figuring out, the thing to sell besides the software and, you know, the services stuff that we have to do for that.
But
and
you can sell the software, too. It doesn't in the hardware. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Right. And so this is great. I can see that it sounds like they found a good placement for where this needs to go in the marketplace, and yet it's still really flexible. You know, do what you want to with it. That's kind of cool.
Right.
It's too bad it's Java, but that's okay.
Come on. Don't be anti Java. A lot of people know how to write Java.
It's true. A lot of people do know how to write Java. And I shouldn't diss it too bad. I mean, it's made a lot of people a lot of money, too, so I should just shut up about
that. Well, I think it's probably a good language for this kind of application, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah. Especially since, you know, Java has inherent threads, and this is an
threaded
application that...
garbage collection? Yeah, there's a lot of, you know...
Yes, exactly.
I mentioned RoboGames, and I just want to finish that thought. It's at robogames.net. It's coming up June 12th through 14th at Fort Mason in San Francisco. I have emceed this before. It's really fun. They have rules, you know, and people design robots, and it's, you know, if you've seen the Robot Wars TV show, it's kind of like that, although you know, not so much flame throwing. It's really
what's
cool.
The fun if you can't blow one of them up?
Well,
come on.
this one is more, you know, like you got kids, you got teams from schools, you got families. It's really neat. If you're interested in robotics and programming of robots and you want to see this at Fort Mason in San Francisco, I will be emceeing on Friday the 12th. I'm, of course, working on Saturday and Sunday, but Friday the 12th, Henry and I, my son and I, are going to go down. We've been down there a couple of times before. And I go just because they play Domo Arigato, Mr. Roboto, right at the beginning. I always enjoy that.
That's definitely appropriate.
I always enjoy that part.
So this is in the 1 hour that you haven't already allocated for the week? You actually put another activity in it?
They asked me, and I've done it before. Dave Calkins, you might have seen him on System. I mean, it's just a fun thing to participate in. I
Very
really
cool.
like to support, as you do, I know, young people who are learning about robotics, about programming. Yeah. You know, look at Bug Labs is a perfect example of a grown-up application of this kind of thing. That's why I asked him about the robotics capabilities.
This and that one little that one board that they had, the van, whatever it was, I forget the guy's name.
Oh, I love that.
All the breakout stuff. That was really cool. Yeah, the little LEDs plugged into it and sort of stuff. Yeah, that's just,
Von Hippel device.
There we go. I mean, again, this is one of the things that I'm actually happy I don't have one of, because I'd be tinkering with it. This is one of those things I don't need. I'm ADD, so to have one more distraction in my house would just be really annoying. So I'm glad I don't have one of these yet.
If I had time, I'd be doing it right now. You can go to the Test Kitchen, by the way. It's on Broadway in New York, New York. There's also a Bug Labs West in San Francisco on Montgomery Street. Ooh.
I know where Leo's going to drop by.
Yeah, I might stop by on the next time I'm down there. Show me some bugs.
Actually, I'll be in San Francisco in a couple of months. I'll stop by there too.
Come up here. Do they really? What's interesting about them, and you have to see, go to the buglabs.net site. They're beautifully engineered. I mean, they're not rough edged. These are really little, beautiful little hardware devices, I think.
That is what I've noticed about it. It really looks like a professional box. I mean, you know, I hate to say it, the Arduino looked a little homebrew.
It's more hobbyist. This is not.
This is real stuff. And that's probably part of what the cost is. They had to pay some designer $100,000 for that box.
You fabricate it and all that stuff. So $250 for the Bug Base. Yeah. And then you add modules. The Von Hippel, for instance, $79. The Bug Sound, $99. The Motion Detector, $59. Yep. The Screen, $120.
It was a touch screen. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So on that.
Think of the applications for that. 320 by 240. Very interesting.
Cool.
Yeah. I could see people prototyping stuff with this.
Mm-hmm. So, you want to know who's coming up on this show?
You know, I always want to know who's coming up on this show.
That's good, because I wanted to tell you who's coming up. Next week, we have Paul Friel.
Tell me who you really, really got.
I'll tell you who I got, who I really, really got. Let's not go any further with that.
That's
please.
Enough. Yes.
Okay. I want to. Anyway.
Really got it. Zig-a-zig floss.
Zig-a-zig floss. God. Okay. This is going in the outtakes, right? No, just kidding. Okay. Paul, there's no such thing as outtakes for this show. Paul Friels is coming up next week. He is the project leader for the Fedora Linux release, and they're having a big release, 11, I think it is, a major release. And the day before we tape is the release date, and so we're hoping it all gets released on time. But he wants to come in and talk about what Fedora is all about and the relationship with Red Hat and how that all came together.
Deal.
So that'll be really fun. It'll be good having a Linux distro on for a change. It's I know I get a few pieces of email from you guys at home at my new address of floss@twit.tv. You can send me email, and a lot of you ask, why aren't you doing more distros? And I go, well, because I like these other things we're doing, too. So what do? I have to put it all in there. But anyway, so he's coming on next week to talk about Fedora. Then the week after that, we have Justin Clark Casey, who is with the Open Simulator Project. That's the basically the open source version of, well, you'd call it like Second Life. Virtual worlds, virtual reality that you can connect to with standard Second Life clients. And people are using this internally for their trainings and meetings internally within companies, and people are using it externally just to build virtual worlds that people can go wander around in. So think Second Life, but completely open source from top to bottom.
And this one is going to be one of those shows where it's a race to see how fast I can get the server up and running during the show, and whether you'll actually be able to join our 3D world before the show is over.
Well, I'll give you a hint. You got to get Mono running first. It's all written in .NET. Ew.
But
it runs in Mono.
Well, at least it's Mono. So it's Linux. It runs on Linux with Mono.
Yeah, it runs Linux with Mono layer on top of .NET above that. Yeah, I found that
but
out.
But the server doesn't need that. The server, does a server need that? Or
no,
just the
server,
client?
No, that's the server. The client could be a standard Second Life client. So whatever Second Life clients run on. Like I've got one on my Mac. You probably have one on both Mac and Windows. Yeah, that works
fine.
So
you would download and install the Second Life client, but instead of logging into the Second Life server, you'd log onto this server.
Exactly. They're just like when you on OS X, you have to add some extra URL information to launching it from the command line. But it's not too bad.
I'm going to lose this bet. I don't know if I can install Mono and.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You got 2 weeks to install
Mono first. Isn't that cheating a little
somewhere.
Bit? All right, I'll take a look.
Not at all. Mono's open source. Come on, you know it'll be fine.
No, but I'm pre-installing it.
And then the week after that, we have my buddy Tim O'Reilly. of O'Reilly Media, who created all those wonderful animal books that most of you have on your shelves, including the few books that I've written for Tim. He's going to come on and talk about the past, the future of open source, what the conference business is like, what the book business is like, what new media business is like. He's got answers to everything. They even talk about his biography that he wrote of Herbert, the guy that wrote Dune, Herbert, whatever his name was.
Herbert Frank something. Herbert.
Frank Herbert. I know that's good. Well, that's the last name, not the first name. No wonder I couldn't get a last name for that. So you may talk about that. We'll have to ask him what it was like to be an author.
I think I owe you a thanks because I've never been invited to Food Camp before. Uh-huh. And I just got an invite to Food Camp 08. I mean, 09.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, they invite me to 08. A little late.
You could come last year. I'm sorry.
Last year's Food Camp. No, but that's think that this has something to do with the fact that that Tim might actually be sitting across from me and he didn't want me to.
Oh, that's
bug him.
Good.
So I'm
good. Yeah, we're gonna try to get him in the office as
That'd
well.
That'd be fun. He's just up the road a bit.
I know. Like 20 minutes up the road.
He could ride his he has a ticket. He has one of those folding bikes. He could ride one of those folding bikes over.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. And on the short list, we have John O'Bacon is going to come back on the show. And actually, John is going to be with us for both the Open Simulator show and the O'Reilly Media show, or the Tim O'Reilly show. So we'll have more
Perfect.
Flossing with Bacon on those shows.
Perfect.
It'll be really good for those two, exactly. And I also am going to be talking with John about Jaunty Jackalope, the release that just came out of Ubuntu. We'll put that in the list sometime soon. I don't know exactly when that's going to be scheduled, but it'll come in fairly shortly. I've also got Monty Wydenius, the guy who created MySQL, is also on the short list. We'll be having him talking about the whole Maria database situation.
Yes.
Where he's taken 10 of his cohorts from...
Yeah.
Son, and has started his own company again to make the second version.
Basically, a fork you to Son.
Exactly.
Or to Oracle. Actually, more to Oracle than it is to Son, isn't it?
Well, this was in play already before
the
Son thing, so it's not really related to that. But, and again, if you want to know upcoming guests or suggest future guests, if you go to twit.tv/floss, the link goes from there to my spreadsheet of 175 names after that that I'm still trying to schedule in. I'm getting more every week, Leo. It is great.
Leave yourself some room for something that gets exciting and then cool and you want to get somebody in. Don't book it all solid.
Well, they're not going in this order. They're going in an order that makes sense for me.
All
so
right.
It's whatever I can squeeze in there. So you can go there. You can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Merlin with a Y. I'm constantly twittering about, I'm doing some live streaming now. I'm doing karaoke and stuff from time to time. So, you know, check me out there. I'm announcing it on my Twitter feed. And I'm, you know, talking about things I'm doing all the day, like working for my clients upcoming Floss Weekly shows and guests that I get and stuff. So follow me on there and I say pretty good stuff. And I'm not just talking about lunch. So, you know, it works out pretty nice.
I'm moving now. I'm not moving anymore.
I'm a little box. I'm a little
it would fit
box.
Right in with the rest of Twitter, if you ask me. I'm moving. I'm not moving. I'm on my back.
Get attached to the back of Oprah. And as she's moving around, it could Twitter automatically for
something,
her.
Something better automatically Twitter for. We want to thank again Google for their support of the show. We really appreciate it. And remind you to check out the Summer of Code. The Summer of Code's coming up for some very lucky students. Next year's Summer of Code will be back. And if you're a mentoring organization or you'd like to be, you want to check it out, the Google Summer of Code. That's Google. What is the URL?
Just Google for it. We figured this out last time. Just Google for it. Google for
Google
Summer of Code.
That would probably be the best way to do it.
code.google.com/SOC
if you're too lazy to Google it.
You're too lazy to Google, but you're going to the Google website.
Too lazy
that.
To Google. No one's too lazy to go. Nobody enters URLs anymore. They just Google the word and they go to the
type in Google Summer of Code to Microsoft Search.
Oh, now that would be interesting. I don't know what you'd get.
Or the Yahoo search box. What? Just try your favorite search box.
Actually, yes. if you Google Summer of Code and press I feel lucky, you will go immediately to the correct URL.
Go to Alta Vista.
I'm gonna try that now. Wait a minute, let's try that.
But you go to Yahoo and see if it comes up Summer of Code.
What comes up? I'm going to go to Live Search, which is Microsoft's weird search engine. Look at that. They have different pictures on there. And you can hover, over there's little hotspots on these
pictures.
Oh, that's
just stupid. That's like a game. I don't like games.
Yeah, it's just odd. See, there are all these hotspots on here?
Yeah, what's the point of that?
I don't know. All right, let's see. Summer of Code. Summer of Love? No, Summer of Code. And it also produces the correct result as the very first result. code.google.com/SOC.
So really, you can get to this webpage so many different ways.
You can use Microsoft to get there.
Exactly.
All right, dude. A pleasure as always. Okay. Thank you for bringing me robots. Thank always you, fun. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.